Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The phone rang at about 5:30, very early in the morning, and it was my mother.
And he said, Jane,
I want you to brace yourself, she said, because I've got some bad news for you.
One of your brothers is dead.
Daniel's dead.
It's just over 6 weeks now since a private detective called Daniel Morgan was found dead in a car park of a pub in South London. It was gruesome. He'd been killed with an axe.
30 years ago, a private detective was brutally murdered, and it still hasn't been solved. I'm Peter Jukes, and I'll be exploring how one man and his family began to unravel the truth.
Untold, the Daniel Morgan murder. If you haven't heard this story, ask yourself, why?
Welcome back to the Daniel Morgan Murder Podcast. And let me tell you what we now know of the crime scene of Daniel's murder. Warning, there are some graphic images ahead. Daniel Morgan's body was found around 9:40 p.m. in the car park at the back of the Golden Lion pub in Sydenham, lying between his car and another. Forensics would show he had been struck 3 times on the back of the head with an axe. Any of those 3 blows would have killed him instantly. But while he lay prone on the ground, the killer stood over him and landed a 4th blow to his face, which was so forceful it severed his brainstem. The axe was left in the body. Nearby on the gravel were Daniel's car keys and 2 bags of crisps he had bought for his 2 young children. His expensive Rolex watch was not found on the body, but in his jacket pocket was £1,000 in cash he'd collected earlier that day from his office. The right-hand trouser pocket of Daniel's brand new suit was also torn at the seam. Previously on episode 1, we discovered the origins of Daniel's detective firm, Southern Investigations, which he'd set up with his business partner, Jonathan Rees. We also discovered that they'd fallen out badly, partly due to a cash-in-transit run that Rees had organised with some friendly police officers that ended up with a suspicious heist. Rees was known as a police groupie in London in the 1980s, and his very good friend was a man called Detective Sergeant Sid Fillery, also known as the King of Catford Crime Squad. In the days before his death, Daniel had been obsessed by police corruption, and various sources say he was planning to sell that story to Fleet Street, the British press. On the morning after the murder, after hearing the dreadful news, Alistair wanted to talk to one person above all.
I was obviously in shock, you know, and I put the phone down. And what I wanted to do at that point was to ring up Jonathan Rees to find out what had happened. I wanted to be prepared in my mind when I went up to London. I wanted to know what I was going to be facing.
What was Jonathan Rees like in those days? Well, here's Laurie Flynn, co-author of the seminal book on police corruption, The Untouchables, describing Rees and Fillery. He met them both many times.
Rees was a different kind of man. He grew up in Yorkshire. He struck me as someone who was much less jocular than his pal Sid, much more serious and driven, and much sharper in his insights, into his cunning. I mean, he was much less easy to take to. Rhys always struck me as someone who was clearly the brain was whirring.
Desperate to find out more from his brother's company, Alistair had to wait 5 hours until the office opened.
I had to wait until about 9 because he wouldn't be in the office, and I rang up and my brother's office manager, Peter Newby, answered the telephone. And I said to him, Peter, what's happened? And he said, I think I'd better hand you over to John. So I then began talking to Jonathan Rhys, and I said, what's happened? What's happened, John? And he said, Daniel and I had a meeting arranged last night at a pub in Sydenham. And he said, do you know Sydenham? And I said, no, I don't know. He said it was a kind of grotty area, was how he described it. Full of druggies and all that, he said. And then he said, Daniel and I were going to meet a third party. And I thought, don't talk to me about meeting third parties when my brother is dead, John. And he said Daniel had gone out to the car park and he'd been mugged, fatally mugged in the car park.
Mugged, implying a robbery.
Yeah. And I said to him, what did they do to him, John? What did they do it with? How did they kill him? And then he sort of hesitated and he said, I think he was bludgeoned to death.
Which implies blunt trauma.
Yeah. Yeah. And anyway, I remember I said, right, I'm coming up to London now, John. And I remember I wanted to see him.
Bludgeoned, fatally mugged, a third party present. Things get garbled in a crisis, but what is clear even 30 years later was that Alistair was now deeply suspicious of his brother's business partner, Jonathan Rhys, and wanted to see him face to face.
I got to the office. Jonathan Rhys wasn't there. And Peter Newby and Tony Pierce were in the office.
Employees
of Southern Investigations. And they were looking absolutely traumatised, they were. And they told me that Jonathan Rhys was with the police.
At this precise moment in time, Jonathan Rhys was giving a statement under caution as one of the last known people to see Daniel alive. Rhys had been informed of Daniel's murder at home around midnight the night before. According to the police officers present, his wife Sharon had carried on watching TV despite the shocking news. So Rhys was taken to the police station for a routine forensic test on his clothes. But he'd been at home for hours. He was wearing slippers when the police arrived. The next morning, Rhys's good friend, Detective Sergeant Sid Fillery from Catford CID, was assigned to the murder squad, partially because Daniel had been killed in his police area. It was Fillery who turned up at Southern Investigations to take Rhys away for interview. Witnesses also claim he took some documents. Daniel's office diary was removed and some files on Belmont Auctions, a cash-in-transit security job which Fillery had set up with Rhys the year before, during which £18,000 had been stolen in mysterious circumstances. Failing to see Rhys face-to-face, Alistair went back to Daniel's detached house in Norwood Green to see the family.
So I left and then I went round to my brother's house. And God, that was an awful moment. Walking up to the door of my brother's house and thinking, you know, what am I going to find here now? You know,
how old were his children then?
Well, there were 2 children, 6 years old and 4 years old, you know, little young children. I remember I actually sat down and broke down on the doorstep. You know, I couldn't... I just didn't know what to do. And then I kind of pulled myself together and knocked on the door, walked in, and it was awful, awful. Everyone was just in an awful state of shock, and there were a lot of tears, and probably within an hour or so, a car pulled up outside. I was watching because I knew my mother was going to be coming up. You know,
from Wales?
From Wales, yeah. And I saw this car pull up, and then I saw my mother getting out of the car, and I thought, well, I've got to go out. And I walked out into the street. I knew that she didn't know what had happened to him. And then I had to tell her, you know, I had to say, Mum, Daniel was murdered. She dropped the bag in the street and just screamed out loud and ran up the road, you know, and I had to just run up the road after and sort of grab hold of her and hug her, you know. Awful, awful. And she was, no, it was just awful. And then I took her into the house and I think somebody got some brandy out or something like that, and we had a shot of brandy because I needed one myself.
Jane, the youngest of the family, was also the last to find out that her brother Daniel had been murdered.
And he must have told me, and Daniel's been murdered at this point now, because...
I knew that.
Yeah. Well, then I just went completely berserk. Shock. Can't be Daniel. He can't be murdered.
There were several of us sitting round the kitchen table, and then Jonathan Rhys suddenly appeared at the back door of the house. Now, that was how people who knew Daniel would come to the house. And he came in, and I was watching him. He looked kind of manic, is the word I would describe it. Uncomfortable, deeply uncomfortable, tense, really tense. And I said, well, John, this is my mother. He'd never met my mother before. And he said something like, hello, dear. And that was all he said, you know. Anyway, he seemed in a hurry to go, and I remember he was trying to get out, and I said, no, hang on a minute, John. I said, hang on a minute. I said, I want to talk to you, John. This was on the patio at the back of Daniel's house. He said, okay, Alistair, it's going to be nasty. And I said, well, of course it's going to be nasty. You know, my brother's just been killed. Of course it's going to be nasty. And he said, okay, then, sort of reluctantly, and he said, well, there's a pub nearby we can go to talk. So I said, yeah, fine, let's go along there. One of the first things he said in the pub was, I've been to the mortuary. It was still in his head. And then I said to him, what was it, John? What did they kill him with? And he said, it was something between a machete and a cleaver. Japanese. He gave me this description, which conjured up in my mind some kind of Oriental martial arts.
A triad killing.
Something like that. So I had this kind of weird image of some kind of ivory-handled Japanese or Chinese sword.
Okay, we know from sworn witnesses at the inquest that Rhys was taken by Fillory to identify Daniel's body earlier that day. But we also know from the same witnesses the axe had been removed during a post-mortem. When Rhys and Fillory saw Daniel, his wounds had been suited and cleaned up, and he looked peaceful in a viewing room. How could Rhys have still seen the axe in his head? Had he somehow seen him the night before? Or was it just something somebody else had said? And why tell Alistair this gruesome detail if he hadn't seen it? The confusion of the moment, perhaps. One note about this Oriental axe. Though it was made in China and called a diamond brand, it was actually a perfectly standard, normal hand axe.
I thought, I need to read the newspapers quickly. I need to see what I can find out from the newspapers. So I went to the nearest newsagent. I think it was probably about a quarter of a mile away. I walked to the nearest newsagent, and I remember there was a copy of the Evening Standard. And I bought this paper, walked out of the shop, opened it up, and there on page 3, or the top of corner of page 3, was a picture of my brother's face in the newspaper. And I remember thinking then, this is not a bad dream. In it, it said it was a 14-inch axe, a hatchet, you know,
so quite a big axe.
The kind of thing that people have in the garden shed to chop up
to make kindling, yeah.
Yeah. And I thought, and I remember thinking, well, if you were at the mortuary and you saw it in his head, why are you leaving me with the impression there's some kind of martial arts tool?
Because there was nothing martial arts
about it. No, it was an ordinary
hand axe.
Yeah. I thought he's trying to dissociate himself from it in some way. I'd read earlier in the day in the Evening Standard report that the axe had been taped, that the assailant, the killer, had put rings of elastoplast up above and below the place where the hand, in order to stop it slipping, if you like. And then I thought, well, he was probably wearing gloves so as not to leave fingerprints. And it all seemed to me, I thought, this was planned.
By now, with all this misinformation about the axe, about a mugging, about a third party being present, you can see why Alistair was deeply suspicious and wanted to talk to the authorities.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Right, so now's a good time for a brief interlude about the Metropolitan Police Force. It's one of the oldest police forces in the world. Founded in 1829 by Sir Robert Peel, its officers were known as Bobbies or Peelers. Internationally, the British police have a pretty good reputation. In fact, there's a joke that expresses this. It's called Heaven and Hell. So Heaven is where the French are the chefs, the Italians are the lovers, the British are the police, the Germans are the mechanics, and the Swiss make everything run on time. But Hell is where the British are the chefs, the Swiss are the lovers, the French are the mechanics, the Italians make everything run on time, and the Germans are the police. But is this reputation for good policing deserved? Well, maybe not so much today.
It's worth recalling the marvellous quote, "A good police force catches more criminals than it employs," one of the most telling aphorisms of the 1970s. Well, supposedly, by the mid-80s, the Met had been cleaned up, reformed, refurbished, and the extremely important work of Sir Robert Mark was bedded in. And once again, we had the greatest police force in the world. This is an enduring myth.
Of course, not a lot of people really knew that at the time. I didn't. And back in March 1987, Alistair had no reason to distrust the police and actually wanted to help them.
I can remember we drove to Sydenham and I walked up to the front desk at the police station. I said, hi, my name's Alistair Morgan. I'd like to talk to somebody on the Daniel Morgan murder investigation squad. I said, is Sid Fillery on the squad?
Just a word about the original Daniel Morgan murder squad. It was headed up by Detective Superintendent Douglas Campbell, and his second was Detective Inspector Alan Jones, who Alistair met that day.
We sat down at the table and he looked at me and he said, "And what were you doing last night then?" And I was just totally taken aback by this approach. And I said, I remember I was quite angry. I said, "Look, Inspector," I said, I don't like your tone. I said, my brother's just been brutally murdered. I said, "I've come here to help you. And, you know, before I've opened my mouth, you're treating me like a suspect." The interview had got off to a really bad start. And then the next thing he asked me, he said, "What do you know about women in your brother's life?" I said to him, I said to D.I. Jones, I said, "Look, I don't want to talk to you about this. I said, I want to talk to Sid Fillery." I said, "Is he here?" And he said, "No, he's out on inquiries at the moment." And I said, "Well, when can I see him?" And he said, "You'll have to come back tomorrow afternoon."
Getting nowhere with the police, Alistair took the first of what would be many, many journeys to the crime scene, the car park behind the Golden Lion in Sydenham. It was already dark, but less than 24 hours since his brother had been murdered.
So we drove down the road. It was only literally a few hundred yards away.
The Golden Lion.
And we drove into the car park.
We went back to the crime scene a few months ago, Nearly 29 years after his brother's murder, Alistair's memory of the place is still fresh.
It was dark. That was the first impression I got. There was very, very little light. Unlike, there's now a block of flats there, but before it was just a row of trees, poplar trees.
Oh, yeah.
Thick trees. Over there, as you can see, there's nobody looking in, if you like, from that place there. And on that side, there's the wall of a supermarket. So it was just, nobody could look into this place. And it was dark, and I don't know why, but instinctively I just thought that this was where this, and I was right just when I later saw photographs. Yeah, just here, I thought this is where they, because that's also a dark, that corner was even extra dark, you know.
So just to describe the scene, there's the pub outside on the main street.
The pub is about 50 yards away.
Yeah, a long way away.
Yeah.
And there's a long alleyway that goes past a quite extensive beer garden, but the beer garden is kind of covered, the aspect there covered with ivy, you can't see from there. And then cars would park here, wouldn't they?
So there were a few cars parked on either side of this car park, probably about half a dozen, I think, when I came here.
And when you came, there was no crime scene that had been cordoned off?
No, there was no cordon, there was no sign that anything unusual had happened here at all.
As you can see from this description, it was a perfect place for an assassination. Alistair explained more when we got back to the studio.
If you shoot somebody, then there's gunshot. If you stab somebody,
they can
scream or run or fight back. But if you hit somebody on the head with an axe, it's immediate.
Now, the other important thing about the Golden Lion is this was not a regular pub of Rhys or Daniel. In fact, they never went there, except for the night before the murder, where they met with Fillory and there was some kind of argument, according to witnesses. So why did Daniel go back for only the second visit of his life? And of course, why did he park round the back? Was it important that the Golden Lion came under Catford, under Sid Fillory's CID catchment? By now, given all the red herrings about axes, muggings, third parties, affairs, Alistair was beginning to think that Rhys had been feeding him misinformation and probably also feeding the police. Like any good detective, Alistair decided to check out his hypothesis and, after consulting with a friend, laid the bait to test Rhys.
We drove to a call box and I rang Rhys and his wife answered the phone. I said, can I speak to Jonathan? Oh, he's not here at the moment, she said. And I said, well, look, can you tell him that I've been to the police and that they've asked me questions about Daniel's private life that I didn't want to answer until I'd spoken to him. And I said, I'm going back to Iris's house now. Can you ask him to ring me? So I walked from the call box to my sister-in-law's house, which was about 100 yards. I remember I walked in through the door, just about had time to sit down, and the phone rang.
This is before mobile phones,
yeah,
he wasn't around.
Yeah,
a bit
yeah, yeah.
Unlikely.
Well, the phone rang very, very quickly.
Yeah.
So I picked up the phone and it was him and he said, what's this, Alistair? What's this? I knew he was desperate to find out, you see, what the police had suggested to me about his private life. And I said, look, John, I can't talk here. We need to go out to talk about this. So I put the phone down, put my jacket on again, walked out the front door, walked... Oh, God, it couldn't have been 100 yards down the street, and he was there in the car. I remember thinking, I'm getting into this car now.
Is it safe?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, this is a man whom I believe has murdered my brother, and I'm getting into a car with him, you know? So I thought, right, okay, I'll get in the car. And I remember he wanted to know instantly. He said, what's this, what's this? And I thought, I'll keep him waiting. And I said, look, let's go somewhere where we can talk. Anyway, we walked into this place and I thought, I'll buy the drinks. And I can remember I bought myself a Guinness because I wanted him to wait.
Ah, so you were milking it.
Yeah, I wanted him to wait. I explained to him what the police had asked me. I said, what was Daniel doing? You know, he said, Alistair... He had half a dozen women on the side that I knew about, and there was probably another half a dozen that I didn't. So I thought, oh,
What, this is
exactly
multiple red herrings?
Yeah, exactly. What he was making out was that I thought my brother was worked hard. Mm. You know, he drove, I mean, a prodigious sort of sexual appetite, you know, and I mean, I knew it was complete rubbish.
Some personal background to the marriage of Daniel Morgan and Iris. Their marriage was in difficulties. Daniel did have a girlfriend, a casual affair with a woman, a married woman called Margaret Harrison. Actually, he'd met Margaret Harrison in a wine bar an hour or two before he went to the Golden Lion the night he was murdered. As it turned out, Margaret Harrison was also being pursued at that time by Jonathan Rees, and they actually live together now. So, was jealousy a motive? And the irony is, if Rees is planting the idea of jealousy as a motive, well, wouldn't he be one of the jealous ones? Anyway, by this point, Jane had arrived from Germany with her husband, Justin.
My job then was just to comfort my mother, who was in a worse emotional mess than me. She just seemed to be in a duffel coat, all buttoned up and toggled up and sort of cold and shaking and catatonic. And I can remember on about the second day that I'd reached London, Alistair coming to tell my mother and I in the evening, he had a suspicion that Jonathan Rees was behind Danny's murder. And I was just absolutely dumbfounded that he thought that John Rees had done it, because it's sort of, Danny's life had seemed so sort of normal, not the sort of person, I don't know what sort of person gets murdered, but you don't feel your brother, who's just a normal guy. And Jonathan Rees, by the same vein, just seemed like a normal guy, not a murderer.
So
Daniel didn't seem like a victim, and this one didn't seem like a person who would murder someone. So, and I was at the stage, I remember I'd had a nightmare the night before, that the police had told me that they'd found the person who'd killed Daniel, and it was a drug addict. And he'd killed Danny because he thought he was Humpty Dumpty and smashed his head like an egg. And so I'm there dreaming that somebody killed Danny because they were on high drugs, Class A drugs, and thought he was Humpty Dumpty. And Alistair is so many leagues ahead of me that he's actually thinks he knows who killed Daniel. And he's going to tell the police tomorrow.
On the 12th of March, 2 days after the murder, Alistair finally got to see Detective Sergeant Sid Villery. Here at last was a police officer he'd met, someone his brother knew, someone he could trust. Perhaps now he'd finally get somewhere.
I showed up in the afternoon. I was shown into this little interview room. It was a rather Spartan, unwelcoming little place with sort of bars on the window and a kind of big steel ashtray on the floor. So I came in and sat with Fillory. And I then went over everything that had gone through my mind, everything that I'd seen, all my conversations with Rees, how he'd behaved. And I told them really what I've said so far. I told him my suspicions about Belmont. And then when I raised the Belmont thing, he said, "What robbery was that then?" I didn't even know the name of Belmont.
Right. It was just a
firm of car auctioneers. That's all I knew. It was quite obvious that I was very, very suspicious of Rees. "We're pursuing a number of lines of inquiry at the moment," he said. "We can't go rushing down what could be a blind alley simply on your gut feeling."
Is that what he said?
Yeah, that's what he said. Now, neither of the officers were taking any notes of what I was saying, and I just thought, they're not listening to me. And anyway, I was getting up to go, and Fillory said to me, he said, "If you've got any issues, you can ring me about it and we can go and have a pint together and talk about it."
We now have much more information about what Fillory was doing, both before the murder and immediately afterwards. Important to note that despite seeming oblivious to the Belmont car auctions heist, it was Fillory who'd set up the team to do the cash-in-transit job a year before. Let's not forget that, of course, Rees, Daniel and Fillory had met in the Golden Lion on the Monday night, the night before the murder. On the Tuesday morning, there are phone records indicating that Rees had called Fillory at Catford Police Station. A few hours after interviewing Alistair on the evening of the 12th on the Wednesday, Fillory submitted a verbal report to the murder squad. That report referred to Rees's statement he'd taken the previous day and very much went down the line of adulterous affairs and potentially jealous partners. In his report, Fillory passed on information that Daniel was having yet another affair, not with Margaret Harrison, and indeed having an affair with this other woman's sister. Well, it's pretty obvious, at least to me, in which direction Fillory is trying to steer the investigation. The next day, while Alistair was out following leads and making his own investigations, Detective Sergeant Fillory of the murder squad called the traumatised Morgan family.
Iris's brother-in-law, Joe Harty, his job was to answer the phone. And in the afternoon, he came to me and he said, "Jane, I've just had a call," he said, "from Sergeant Sid Fillory at the murder squad incident room. And he said he's a great friend of Daniel's. Great friend of Daniel's, and he's going to shift heaven and high earth to catch Danny's killers. But, he said, there's a problem. He asked if the family could try and get Alistair out of London, because he's muddying the waters and hindering the investigation." And I thought, oh, my God. Now, on top of Danny being dead, now Alistair is... His theory that Jonathan Rhys is behind Daniel's killing is way off beam.
And causing
problems. And I was thinking, oh no, we don't need this on top of that. And we'll have to try and get Alistair, because you believe the police. I did. Thought, yes. I'd never heard of Sid Fillory. And I did remember thinking, well, if he's such a great friend of Daniel's, how come Daniel has never spoken of his great friend, Sergeant Sid Fillory? But nevertheless...
You trust the police.
And so... Oh, then I went and told my mother, and we thought, how on earth what possible excuse, lie, can you make to get Alistair out of London at this time without telling him the truth? So I put this to Alistair, please, can we leave London? Let's just go home to Wales, where we can be together, not split up in other people's houses, and get Mum home and try and nurture her.
Jane or Justin has said, "Alistair, the police have rung up and said that you're getting in the way of the inquiry." And then Justin, who was an army officer, said, "Alistair, leave it to the professionals." And I said, "God," I said, "if you'd seen the people that I'd been talking to so far, you wouldn't be talking about that." I said, "They didn't even take any notes. I've been trying to help them." And anyway, it was almost a stand-up row in the street.
Instantly, no. You can go back to Wales, but I'm staying in London. I've got to find out who killed Daniel. And Justin, he said to my husband, "You take Mum and Jane to Wales, but I'm not coming with you." "Oh, well, yes, we need you, Alistair. We need you to help us deal with this." And no, you must be insane. Don't even think it. And of course, he's backing away from us and waving his arms. So we're not in the garden anymore. We're in the street, in the dark, still trying to persuade him to come to Wales with us, and failing miserably.
Because they were worried that I was purportedly messing up the investigation. And I was saying, "No, all I've been doing is trying to help the police."
Then he just said, "No, right, and walked off. So we went back into the house, and then we had to go to Wales. We've got to go to Wales now. We've backed ourselves right into a corner. So we went to Wales.
Little did they know, but the day after Jane went back with her mother to Wales and Alistair was exiled to Hampshire, Detective Sergeant Sid Fillory was suspended from the murder squad for his close connections to Jonathan Rhys.
One morning, it must have been about 3 weeks after the murder, I got a phone call from a friend. He said, "Alistair, they've arrested 6 people in connection with your brother's murder."
Well, it's like a bombshell, because that's the second time I've heard this name.
So I just rushed out to the local newsagent and grabbed every single paper that was on sale.
And the first time is he wants the family to get Alistair out of London.
In one of them, and it was actually the Daily Star, which is not a paper that I read. I'd bought everything. But in this particular paper, it named all the people who'd been arrested.
He's been arrested in connection with Daniel Skilling.
They'd arrested Jonathan Rhys, his 2 brothers-in-law, Glenn and Gary Vian, 3 police officers, one of whom was Detective Sergeant Sid Fillory.
Next week, what happens with the rests of Rhys and Fillory? A funeral, a secret press campaign, and a TV reconstruction of the murder, which goes horribly awry.
Episode 2 was supported by GMB West. Produced by Peter Jukes and Devi Amir. Soundtrack by Shameli Mir. A Flameflower Duende production. And remember, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, listen on the Acast app, and get extra images and background notes alongside the audio, or visit untoldmurder.com. Hold On by the Lemingtons.
Out of the shop, down the fire escape onto the street, there's a steel rail you can reach.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.